Good morning, all the people that have arrived on time. You get the special announcements. Thank you all for all being here. I'll make them quick, however. My name is Romy. I want to thank you and welcome you to Spirit Rock. Thank you for being here, and we are happy to have you today. So I want to first acknowledge the volunteers. They're actually still outside, most of them, helping you come into the room and getting you your handouts, getting the chairs ready, etc. We can't do it without volunteers, so if you're interested in volunteering in the future, you can see me. I want to remind you, CE credits. Those of you that need continuing education credits, you should have already signed in. If you haven't, please come with me at the end of my announcements. We'll get you signed in. You must sign out at end of day to receive your certificate. Lunchtime, it is a gorgeous day, so there are benches out in the meadow. You can eat outside. I'm going to ask you not to go to the upper retreat area. There's a wood sign that says, please do not pass, because we do have a residential silent retreat up there. We also have a retreat upstairs, or a day long upstairs today. So I'm going to ask you guys to stay downstairs. They'll stay upstairs. We'll ring a bell, right, Bruce? We're going to ring a bell when we come in from walking meditation or lunch or break. If you hear other bells that don't make sense to you, it's probably not your ears ringing. It very possibly could be the bells for the room upstairs. So if we go for a half an hour walking meditation and it feels like it's only been 10 minutes, it's probably the other group. I forgot to mention when we were talking about lunch, if you did not bring lunch today, the Woodacre Deli is across Sir Francis Drake, and I can give you directions. Books. We have a self-serve bookstore across the way. We also have books from Andrea and Alyssa, and they'll be signing books towards the end of lunch. We'll remind you maybe at lunchtime. We'll be outside in the tea area signing books. Just Andrea. There are a couple. Okay, well, we'll see. We will sign books for as long as the books are available. How about that? Surveys. So this afternoon, Jesse's giving me some direction. This afternoon, in your email, you'll receive a survey for today. If you have the time to fill it out, we do appreciate it, and we do look at your comments and change the day accordingly. Assisted hearing devices. If you're having a hard time hearing me, we have assisted hearing devices in the back. Jesse can get you one. They work great. And please feel free to take an assisted hearing device. I am now going to welcome our teachers. They'll introduce themselves to us, and we'll hear about true nourishment. Look forward to the day. If you have any questions, please see me. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
So welcome, everyone. Can you all hear me? Great. Well, we're delighted that you're here joining us on this absolutely gorgeous day. So we'll have some nice time outside, lunch and walking practice, and to see the beautiful sunshine coming in and nourishing us. So we're going to just take a moment to introduce ourselves. First, I'd love to know who's in the room. How many of you, is this your first time being at Spirit Rock? Wow,
yes,
wonderful.
That's so great.
Yeah, well, welcome. Hopefully this is your first time of many. There are many wonderful retreats here. And how many of you are new to mindfulness practice? Raise your hand. Okay, great. A few of you. Oh, welcome. So I'm Andrea Lieberstein. I'm a mindfulness meditation teacher, a mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher of over 25 years now, and a mindfulness-based registered dietitian nutritionist. I teach and coach in mindful eating. I lead retreats across the country and around the world. And I've led a few here this year. Some of you may have been at some of the mindful eating retreats I've led. And just really delighted to be here once again. Jhampa, Venerable Jhampa, and Alyssa and I have taught here for 3 years. This is our first, our theme is always nourishment. We've taught 3 mindful eating retreats, a science and practice, and this year we're really broadening out the retreat to really look at nourishment, how this practice nourishes us in all its forms, true nourishment, from mind to heart to cell to beyond. So I'm going to...
I'm Alyssa Eppel, and I'm a professor in Department of Psychiatry, but I'm a psychologist, and I've been studying also for 25 years, doing the same thing, doing research on the mind-body connection. And I focus on really just what is stress, deconstructing stress, and understanding how it gets into the body and how we can modulate that. And so one of the things that I really love doing is stretching and challenging myself to talk about what that means in real lives. So I will be talking about said studies, but I'll also be talking about, you know, what this means for us in the moment. And that's the, you know, the helpful part. So I think what's fun for today is that you're going to be hearing a little bit of science, wisdom from Buddhism, and practice from Andra. A little bit of all three from all of us, but mostly it's kind of a three perspective view on wellness, nourishment, and aging. And I'm so happy you're all here.
Can you hear me? Good, good. Good morning. My name is Jompa Sangmo. I am a ordained Buddhist nun, hence the outfit, in case you didn't figure that out already, you know, kind of comes with that. I've been a meditator longer than some of you have been alive, so I'll age myself. So I started meditating, and it's so long ago, I don't remember what year, but I think it was 1966. At UCLA was my first introduction. I'm not saying I was any good at it the first several decades, you know, and I'm not saying I'm any good at it now, but I know a lot about the subject, okay? Mm-hmm. And I actually started out with Spirit Rock way before all these buildings were built. And so it's a great honor to be here and come back to see this. This is amazing, right? So I've taught meditation in the Bay Area, primarily in California, and to both in centers and in corporations. Okay. So the first thing I want to start with, I think some of you, I want to make sure everybody turned off their cell phones, okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't know about any of you, but I've had some I have one very embarrassing moment with my cell phone going off at a highly inappropriate time. Maybe none of you have ever had that happen, but I wasn't being very mindful that day, obviously. So just to double check, but I want to let you know that I have all my notes on my cell phone, so I will be referring to it, and also I keep time on the meditation on the cell phone. That reminds me, we need that thing, right? Yeah, So we're all turning those off, and we'll hope for the best with that. So I want to talk that I see there's some new to meditation, and I'm sure there are some of you who have been maybe meditating as long as I have or longer and have great practices, but we can never hear the instructions too often, I feel. And we're all beginners today. Every single one of us is a beginner. It's a new day, it's a new moment, it's a new practice today. We're all coming into that. So just to know that. Before I start with instructions, I see a few of you who look like you have really incredible posture. Lucky you. I want to make sure that when we sit to meditate, that you think about the comfort of nourishing yourself in the way of comfort for your body. So the last thing that we ever want is for you to be in pain. I mean, we all have a certain amount of body pain, particularly at my age, but I don't want you to be uncomfortable. So if if you are on the floor and you think like, well, sitting for a meditation is going to be challenging, or you're going to be in a lot of discomfort, grab a chair. And remember that the Buddha said that appropriate practices are sitting, standing, right, walking, lying down. And the next historical Buddha, Maitreya, whenever you see a statue, there's not one here of him, he's sitting in a chair. I don't think he's going to be born with the chair, but he's going to find this really special, fantastic chair the minute he gets there. I'm sure it'll be waiting for him. So one should feel quite comfortable with doing that. We're most of us in this culture did not grow up, you know, sitting on the floor, so our posture is a little, you know, more chair posture. Okay, so I just want to make sure that you're that. So let's talk about, we're going to have several meditations throughout the day, but I want to talk about what meditation is. It's kind of important, you know, important subject, what it is. So many of us, we come and we sit to meditate. And the first thing we notice is that the mind, which is what we're going to do, we're going to be coming familiar with this mind, which, and we'll talk more about the nature of the mind later, but it's clear and knowing. So when we sit, particularly in the morning, what do we find? We find that the mind can become very agitated. It gets very busy. Maybe we woke up in a grumpy mood. Maybe we woke up in a happy mood. Hard to know. So the mind, right, has that quality. And our job as the meditator is to have a knowing of what quality is arising in the mind at that perceived moment. So when we sit on the cushion, which is really a laboratory for becoming familiar with the mind, we have the possibility of awakening to that moment. Grumpy mood. Oh, okay. It arises, it will be present, and we can let it abandon. Just that simple. Just go by. Then the next thing arises. So it is the knowing of what is arising in the mind. The mind is not necessarily blissful. It is not necessarily happy. It is not necessarily completely nourished. These are byproducts. These things, these awakening, the ultimate Buddhist goal, right? These are byproducts of meditation. So when we sit and the mind is so busy, yes, of course, everybody's mind is busy, right? And it is just to begin to know it, to know it. So how is the mind busy? That is what we're going to work on. Or how is the mind so tired? We sit, we find, oh, I am so tired. I could be home in bed today. That would be so great. It was so comfortable, right? Then the mind gets too cool, gets maybe that little feeling of comfort, that cozy kind of feeling, like we get in bed and it's all nice and toasty on a cool day. That then we know we're too cool. What we want is we want the mind to have a clear comprehension, an awareness of what is arising. Where is the mind? Is it in the future, chasing off after, you know, next time I come to Spirit Rock, this is what I'm going to do. Oh, you know, I'm going to bring my lunch. I'm going to hike. I'm going to go to that, you know. Or is it in the past? Is it like at home, right? Is it yesterday? Is it still at work? Where is the mind, right? These are the things that we need to pay attention to. And as we pay attention to them, we can see them arise. We can see them present. We can see them be abandoned. We're not going to cling on to any thought or feeling. We're going to just notice them. Okay, it's important to understand that at the beginning of meditation and at any time, it's a skill set. All right? It's a skill set, like learning to be on a surfboard or a skateboard or learning to ski or ride a bike. Maybe some of you, I remember when I first learned to ride a bike. I'm not an athlete. I know that's a big shock looking at me. You know, I just saw Billie Jean King on TV. You know, I'm like, that's what an athlete looks at my age, you know, not this way. So the thing is, it's wobbly, right? So we have to develop this openness, this curiosity, and this incredible kindness for like, oh my gosh, I'm going to take a look at this mind. Let's see what happens. We're going to use the breath as an anchor. Why? Why not? It's portable, right? It's with us all the time. So far, so good. For those of you who think it might be boring, oh, breath, I really like it when they talk to me, or mantras, or this, that. If you stop breathing right this moment, if you stop, it will be the most interesting thing in the world, and the bliss of the next breath might carry you all the way to enlightenment. That breath. But more important, I mean, it is important to be breathing, there's no question about that. But also, it puts us in our proper place. And it is the freedom of knowing. This I am that we kind of cling to. It is to understand that when we are breathing, we do not make the air. We do not make it. We are dependent upon it. We are dependent upon all the causes and conditions. And this moment, to be at Spirit Rock, to have this incredibly beautiful view, to have clean air. We didn't make the clean air. Even with all our Priuses, we didn't do it. Right? It was here before the Prius. It was here before we were here. It was here long ago. We are dependent and one with this breath on this planet we call Earth at this moment. And within that spaciousness, all things can arise, including our thoughts and our feelings. So in meditation, there is a traditional way that we sit, and I'm going to go through the posture. And then we're going to sit for about 15 minutes. And I want you to look at it like wonderment. This mind, this amazing mind that's smart enough to get here, to be here, to behold all that is happening. I mean, how fortunate are we? Okay. So with that deep curiosity, what is this? So the posture we're going to be gentle with, we're not 8-year-old little monks that have been trained for the last few years, you know. Some of you will have great posture. Some of us will be whatever. It's all good. Okay? But just to know. So, are we comfortable? If we're on a chair, feet on the ground. Feet on this earth. Feet on this earth. Get comfortable. Yeah. Just kind of rest into it. Relax the body into it. Okay? Eyes cast down. Little bit of light coming through our resting clothes. Whatever's comfortable for you. Adjust the head so the chin is just straight. Yeah. Just like this, right? Soften the belly. Check your legs. Make sure there's no tension in the ankles or the feet. Just kind of relax into it. Tongue on the top of the palate, right behind the front teeth. Now slowly raise the spine. Just slowly raise it. Not with any tension, but just kind of elongate it. feel it. Check in the head, the chin is even. Feel the spine elongate. See if you notice the mind brighten up just a little bit. Now find your breath. And to place the mind on the breath, to anchor it there, we can say to ourselves, in, out. When the mind chases off, notice, what does it run to? Does it run to the future or the past? Does it chase after hearing or some body sensation? And just note it. And in that moment of awakening to this present, with great kindness, bring it back to the breath. In, out. Where is the mind right now? And now. without moving for a moment while the bell rings. Notice the change in the mind. Relief, surprise, change. Sometimes I think the most important moment of meditating is when the bell rings, when I awaken to my grasping for it to be over or my longing for it to stay the same. In that, when the bell rings, I awaken to this moment, this now. So for just a brief thought to set your intention for the rest of this day, what is it? What is your motivation? And may you fulfill it. Good job, everybody. You're all great meditators now, I can tell.
So again, welcome everyone. We've had a few people come in during the practice. So today, we will be integrating Western science perspectives, Buddhist perspectives, and practice. We will have three sections that Alyssa will talk about. You'll be hearing from each of us in each kind of section. And the day will be, while we're in here, we'll be in silence. Lunch will be optional silence. We do encourage you, since we're usually talking in our daily life and we have attention on social consciousness, just to give yourself this time to nourish with the beautiful environment and your food during lunch. But you can talk if you choose to. We have, and we'll give instructions on a mindful eating lunch. And then we have in the afternoon more practice, and we have a special mindful eating practice at the very end of the day that we'll be introducing. And Alyssa's going to talk about the topics.
So we'll have four themes. We're going to start with really understanding what suffering and stress is and the nature of the mind. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about discontent of wanting and craving, not just food, but when you feel an emptiness or you feel discontent, what is that? And how can you work with that to fill the void without food? That's kind of one of our big themes. And then we're going to talk about stress resilience, both What is that? How do we measure that in our science and in studying big populations of how people thrive and cope with disaster, trauma, daily hassles? And also how we can view that from more Buddhist perspectives. And the reason why this is one of my favorite things to do, is to talk about science and Buddhism back to back and have dialogue. Because in Western science is really interesting and valuable and lacking, because there's so much that we don't have a real science of the mind. We understand the brain and neuroscience, but we don't really understand how the mind works. And that's where the Buddhist wisdom comes in and meets the science and provides more of a complete picture. And then we'll talk about, at the last segment, we're going to talk about how we're not alone and social connectivity. And it turns out that what we experience with our perception and our brain is very, very isolating and false. And there are ways that we are affected unconsciously as well as more visibly by our surroundings and by other people, and how we are influencing other people in invisible ways that we're not aware of. So we're going to talk about social connectivity and interdependence. Okay, so let's start with the mind. What did you guys bring today? You each brought something besides your lunch. And some of you might have left a little bit at the door, but we all have things that, you know, with our busy mind, we have situations in our lives that are with us, even when the situation may be far away, it may be over, it might not have happened, but we're thinking about it. And the more loaded and emotional and threatening it is, the more sticky it is and the more likely it is to have come with us where we're sitting right now. So think back to that 15 minutes. That was long if you haven't meditated before. And there probably was a lot of, toward the end, interference. And what I mean by that is the monkey mind or the chattering mind takes over. So if we're trying to focus on our breath, we can do that for a short while. And then we fall back into our habitual thinking. What is our habitual thinking? We're going to look at processes of our mind and content. How our mind thinks and what is the substance, what is the content? Because we're all very similar in these habits of mind and we suffer in similar ways. So let's just start with, think about your last 50 minutes. What was with you besides the focus on the breath? Were there any recurring themes in your thoughts? And what was that in like? Did you notice your mind wandering to other topics? So mind wandering is what we do at least half the time. It's natural. Did you notice perseveration? We call it rumination when you chew on one thought over and over. It comes back. Intrusive thoughts, those are the upsetting ones where if you are trying not to think about something, if you're doing what we call emotion suppression and avoidance, we all do that, and it's absolutely natural and important to do it sometimes, right? We need to focus, and we can't always just let our mind go to what is either most rewarding or most upsetting. But when we have things that we're trying to suppress, our unconscious is working hard to suppress it, and it can't do that forever, especially if we're stressed or emotional, and it pops back in. It's what we call an intrusive thought. And so that happened to me, probably happened to some of you, where something might pop in, and it can be a little jarring, it can knock you out of your concentrative state of focusing on the breath. Those are processes: mind wandering, perseveration, rumination. And then what about, and emotion suppression is a process, that's a way we regulate emotion. What about content? What are some of those common thoughts that you might have noticed once you started trying to focus on your breath? I'm bad at this. So self-criticism is often there at a almost invisible level, because it can be so habitual for some people. And so noticing those thoughts is important. We might think it's good to criticize ourselves and it's helping us be better and it's what we should do. And it's exactly the opposite. It weakens us. It takes our resources. It leaves us with less ability to be present and to do what we really want to do. Rumination. Why do we ruminate? We think we are solving problems. It's like we're working. Like yesterday, I'll give you a recent example. I was doing something that should have taken all my attention, and I just kept lapsing. I was in yoga class, and I was just completely off base with all the moves. I was out of sync with everyone. I was like, what? What's wrong with me? And, oh, I'm working. I'm multitasking. I'm solving a problem, and I won't let it go. Like an iron clamp, I was just going to be going back to this major situation, unsolvable situation in my life that I was going to get work done during yoga class. And so even with all that support of the focus of a teacher guiding me, I was multitasking and completely thought I was working. So I realized that, and I was able to let that go more. But it's that awareness and acknowledgement of, okay, this is funny. This is, you know, completely how the mind works, and I don't have to do that, or I don't have to believe the thought, and I don't have to multitask right now. So the awareness is something that you'll cultivate throughout the day, and maybe you already have that cultivated with a practice. And there are other ways to shift our shattering ruminative mind as well that we'll talk about when we get to resilience. So I just want to support you in knowing that you are here for yourself today and for, you also might have thoughts of, all of you have a lot to do and you chose to come and you made the right choice. And yes, you're going to have more to do when you get back. That list is always going to be there. It's always going to have things added to it. But you're going to have some more skill to find equanimity in the midst of this busyness that we all have. And so you do have a handout that, don't worry about it. We handed it out early just in case you want to write or take notes. And my wish for you is that, number one, that your intention is met, and number two, that in some way that this might support you to write down at least one or two things on this kind of daily list of what you want to do. So what it comes down to is little nudges in the day that we can try to implement and remember. And so we'll review at the end some of these kind of in-the-moment take-home tips. And even if it's just one that you remember or write down, and if you do it every day, it is going to make a difference. We can't control anything but the moment. This is it. It's called the renewed day.
If anyone doesn't, how would you imagine?
So the last thing I want to talk about is as we notice the nature of our mind, the processes, the content, we have to approach it with humor. And none of us have full control of it, even Buddhist monks and nuns. It's a practice. But it's a practice that will...
Don't over impute upon me things I don't have. Just like you. Yeah. I like that waking up is important. I think that's the most important thing.
Waking up. Yeah. What did you think about? What were your first thoughts today when you woke up? Do you remember? Yeah. You might have grabbed your phone and gotten a dose of news. Hopefully not. You might have thought about what your to-do list is. You might have jumped into the kind of rush of the day and getting here. And what we know from studying people's waking up thoughts, we know that people have a whole range of thoughts. They can wake up feeling stress, anxiety, worry, dreading the day, worrying about the day, feeling it's unpredictable, natural, survival mode. But we also wake up feeling joy, feeling positive anticipation, looking forward to something. So that's naturally what people do. We have a range of thoughts. And we found that when you wake up with this more of this, what we call kind of threat appraisals, these ways of activating the body and putting it in go mode the second you wake up, we have our cortisol, our stress hormone, shoot up too high. And it's also related to lower levels of this anti-aging enzyme, telomerase, that helps stabilize our cells and keep them younger. So waking up is something you can notice, and even if you just take 30 seconds to shift yourself from a threat mode to a more positive mode, that we think can make a difference. How do you do that? The smallest ways. Think about something you're looking forward to. Think about something you feel grateful for. These are the things we know that increase positive affect, and that can help us have a different trajectory from that waking startle response. So aging. So you hopefully knew we're going to talk about, have a theme about the body today, longevity in the body. And this is a natural topic to flow from the nature of the mind, because all of these stressful processes that we have or that we can get into with our mind create vigilance in the body. And so they keep our nervous system on vigilant mode, and they just change our baseline level of arousal to a little bit higher. And so that is something that we have control of and we can shift. And what we know from different studies is that, number one, mind-wandering kind of prevents us from being fully content and happy. We're still going to do it, but especially negative mind-wandering when we're feeling like, I don't want to be here now. I wish I was doing something else. What is that thought? That is in itself a form of suffering and discontent. And it's also natural. People have that thought. You might have that if you start looking and noticing. That is associated with accelerated cellular aging in our studies. So what we find when we sample people and we say, how much have you been really focused and engaged on what you're doing versus how much are you just wishing you were somewhere else or doing something else? We find that these work or associate with cell aging in opposite ways. So we want to foster being present, being engaged, being focused, and notice when we're feeling like we don't want to be what we're doing. Yes, question. Yeah. Yeah. So mind wandering is just a process of where we're thinking about things other than what we're doing. It could be fantasizing, daydreaming. If you look, there's a lot of thinking about the future. It's not just the past and ruminating, but really just thinking about what if, or just creating stories. Now, that in itself is not bad, and it's natural. And in fact, it's related to creativity, positive mind wandering, and daydreaming. It doesn't appear to promote happiness. Not that happiness is our only goal. But it's when we are having mind wandering that is really making us feel discontent with the moment. That is what we call negative mind wandering. That's what we want to watch for. So not so much daydreaming and fantasizing, but rather what is that the content of our mind wandering? So what else do we know about aging? We know that part of aging, when we look down at the cellular level, is what is happening inside the cell. So we do have these telomeres at the inside each cell, at the ends of our chromosomes, that are sensitive to the environment. We've been studying them for over 10 years. We know that they get worn down and shortened when we are under chronic stress, especially in children. So we know that telomeres are one way that stress is affecting our aging. When they get too short, our cells can't replenish, renew, and divide, and keep dividing. And so this particularly matters if we want a long health span. So what that means is, well, I guess just think about how long do you want to live? Someone just asked me that a few days ago, and my answer was, You know, what he really wanted to know was, is it 100? Is it 110? What are you aiming for? My answer was, I want to live as long as I have good health. And I don't want to live any longer than that. It's great to do important, wonderful things in this world, but if you're sick, it's really miserable. And we all are going to get old and joint pains. And, you know, aging is inevitable, and we're all going to get somewhat, you know, have our different aging maladies. But those diseases of aging that sap our vitality and our pleasure and put us in chronic pain are miserable. And we want to compress them to the end of life and have a long health span, years of living without those diseases. And that is more under our control than we think. So what we're talking about what's your mind like? What is the nature of your thoughts right now? That is what this is about, because those add up to impacting our daily aging, and that adds up over the years to impact are we staying well and staving off disease. So we have found, another way, we know that chronic stress, especially if we're not coping well, is accelerating our cell aging and shortening our telomeres. We also now know that it's accelerating another way of aging. There's lots of ways that our cells age, but one is called epigenetic aging. And this is something we can look at now. Inside our cells, we can see how much are our genes getting closed off and methylated as we age, so they can't work in the same way and create the right proteins. That just happens naturally as we age. And it's correlated with how old we are, extremely high, like almost 0.9 or so. It's meaning if you tell me how old you are, I can tell you how much methylation your genes have. But again, as with everything biological, there's some plasticity, and some of us are years older than our methylated age should be. And we know that stress is one of the things that pushes that up and accelerates that, and as well as lifestyle. And we're now studying whether meditation could slow that down. So given what we know about meditation and the ability to be more equanimous in the day, we already know that it can slow cell aging. These practices, any mind-body practices, can reduce inflammation, a major pathway of aging, can stabilize telomeres, and we'll see about the epigenetic aging. There's a study that we're just hoping to publish soon that was done right here at Spirit Rock by my colleagues Cliff Sarin and Quinn Conklin. And what we did is we brought in... So there's these one-month residential retreats. It's probably happening right now up there. And these are experienced meditators. And what Cliff did is he randomized... Well, sorry, they had already signed up for the retreat. So there's no randomization. It's an imperfect study. But we measure the blood of everyone at the beginning of the retreat and after the retreat. And then we also measure the blood of people who are regular meditators. So they're pretty much the same. They're probably meditating at home, but they didn't get the benefit of the month here. And we looked at their telomeres. And what we found was in just 3 weeks of living here, immersed in a residential retreat, their telomeres lengthened significantly. At least apparent lengthening. It looks like their cells got younger. So that's our most dramatic study so far. And so this is all, you know, does it last? Does that extend life? We don't know all of that, but we do know we can, in a short-term way, modulate aging. Yes?
I got a question. So when you are discussing the telomeres, mm-hmm. is that something that's inside of every single cell that we have?
Every single cell.
Okay, are they out? So they're not like a specific cell. They're in every single...
Right, so every single cell has the chromosomes that are protected. The genes are in the chromosomes. That's what make us who we are. And at the very tips of those chromosomes are telomeres in every single cell. Some of our cells are dividing cells. Some of the brain, hippocampus, the cardiovascular lining, tissues like kidney, liver, the immune system, those are tissues that must divide throughout our lifespan if we're going to stay healthy. They get damaged, they get old, we need to replenish and renew those cells. So those are the tissues where telomeres really matter. And what we know about is blood. You know, this is what we can look at in humans, but it turns out the immune cells in the blood are really tremendously important anyway, so we get to look at this important system. And so just remember, you know, our issues are in our tissues, and it's not just our head. So that is one of our themes.
You mentioned the word methylating, I believe.
Yes.
And that according to our age,
right,
we have a certain amount.
Exactly.
It can be exacerbated. And it sounds like from the meditation study, it also can be maybe in some way diminished.
That's the million-dollar question right now. So science, you know, we've been saying telomeres for about 10 years. It looks like we can stabilize those with different mind-body activities, with exercise, with meditation. The epigenetic clock, the methylation, we don't know. We're studying it now. Probably lots of people are studying it now. If you come back next year, maybe I'll have answers. But I told you about the clock because it's so interesting. It's so new. We all hear about epigenetics, and now we know we can measure these in a way that is meaningful.
Do we need to define epigenetics?
So we have our genes that we can't change, and then around the genes are a whole set of different proteins that protect the genes and turn them on and off. And these methylation bonds, they turn genes on and off. And so we change our methylation patterns as we age. So that's what we're talking about, the aging of the epigenome, or the methylation patterns that these are regulated throughout our lifespan, and we're all kind of methylating our genes somewhat at the same rate, but not completely. So there's these little differences that matter, and we think we can control those. New area, stay tuned. The other part of epigenetics is that some of that methylation we're born with, and some of that's transmitted from our parents, and that's a very, very new area that we're just starting to understand more. Telomeres, we kind of count that as part of the epigenome. They're not methylation bonds, but they are attached to the genes, and they're not the genes themselves. So they're, you know, we kind of put them in this category of epigenetics, or above the gene. And these we know are transmitted. So we know that we came out at day one of life with shorter or longer telomeres, partly because of our parents' genes, but partly because of our parents' own telomere length. They transmitted it directly. And so if a mother is very stressed during pregnancy, we know that the baby on day one of life in their cord blood tends to have shorter telomeres. So, pregnancy is this tremendously critical period when we can shape the epigenome and the telomeres.
Before pregnancy, if a mother is stressed and has short telomeres, can that be transmitted in a kind of Lamarckian way?
In a epigenetic way, yes. From the grandmother to the granddaughter or grandchild, because it's through the what we call the germ cells, the gametes, the sperm and egg that the mom gets from her stressed mom is what's going to create the grandbaby. So the epigenetics kind of work through skipping a generation. But the direct effect of pregnancy stress, that is a direct way. That is through changing the baby's epigenome, not through the mom's transmission of the genome. It's a little bit complicated, but they both matter. So what our grandparents experienced may be transmitted a bit, and what our mother's stress level during pregnancy is also transmitted. There are fascinating studies on Holocaust survivors and transmission of different patterns of gene expression for glucocorticoid receptors. This is a work of Rachel Yehuda. Yes, last question.
What you bring up for me when you talk about the telomere shortening, and especially due to stress, is a cultural issue, not just a personal issue. Meaning that, the way the culture is, it's stress by its very nature. Whether you're in rush hour traffic, the nature of work and family life and two-income households, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're going to, go into this, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
What can one...
Right. I think the same way as you. And I think that that we have telomere shortening as groups and as societies. And if we were able to look at country level or, neighborhood level stress disparities... versus kind of support and what we call social capital, trust and safety, we would probably be able to predict people's telomeres based on their geographic location, their neighborhood, their zip code. The research has shown that already with neighborhoods. We know neighborhood quality predicts the telomere length of an individual. It's a very interesting question. There are even some researchers who think that when they compare cohort studies through different generations, they think we are shortening over time. That's not certainly a controversial idea, but you know, we have lots to worry about. We have natural disasters. We have sudden, death early in life. And then we have telomeres, the slow burn that will get us, make us sick later in life. So it's one of many ways that we can try to hedge our bets and help with our wellness and longevity, and we never know.
Well, to your question, I always think is interesting. Many times when I've taught on Buddhism and on meditation, particularly because I teach mostly in the United States, but many individuals are from different countries. And, I know that there is this theme of American exceptionalism, and so therefore we think we are the most stressed out, but not necessarily accurate, And I think also from Buddhist perspective, and why we're here today to learn to nourish ourselves, is we cannot control the traffic. Just can't, unless that's your job, and then you're just one person, at whatever transportation little cog that you're working in. However, we do have incredible power over this mind stream, and that is the promise of Buddhism and of meditation, of many other faiths that also meditate, right? So the promise is, yes, there is this suffering. I went from Noe Valley yesterday to go somewhere over near at Fort Mason, and I was with someone whose dog was in surgery. So she was not her best self, Nothing like riding in a car when you're agitated with a Buddhist nun, It will all be fine, It's like, weaving in and out of traffic, as if that's going to make any difference, right? So, yes, it's an amazing event to try and drive across whatever those 3 miles of San Francisco are. It's remarkable, really, how much it can be. Of course, I grew up in L.A., and I've experienced the 405, the really pinnacle of traffic. And what I say is, wow, what a great time to practice patience. Wow, here is my opportunity right now in this neutral thing called traffic that isn't personal, isn't just happening to me, plenty of people on the road, it's not just me, right? I get to practice beholding my agitation or my interest in what's going on, or the colors of the cars, or whatever I want to place my attention on in this huge mind, which is clear and knowing. Now, I'm not saying that I never get startled in traffic. Of course, people are erratic. I get how I used to drive 17 for many years from Santa Cruz to San Jose. Wow, you want an experience. That's it. Well, in the summertime, hello. We used to call them the amateurs, as they would grow. It's the way of it. But we can respond in a different way, or we can, just as we did when we this morning, begin to notice. Oh, annoyed, agitated. Why are all these people driving so incredibly poorly today in California, Northern California? What's up with that? Right? We can notice. And if we get really agitated, I guess we can go to our phone and we can look at Google Maps and figure out why it's happening, right? If we're so interested. Maybe we need to be interested. That would be discernment. Oh, I need to know why this event is happening. Discernment. Wisdom. Right? Insight. Oh, this is highly unusual. Okay, I need to have a little more information. Siri, who can also be quite annoying. I hear she's getting better, but I'm not 100% sure. We can ask, right? That's discernment. But the agitation is impermanent. It arises in this clear and knowing mind, huge, right? That is taking in this event. It can be present, and then it will change, just like when the bell rang. Did your mind change when the bell rang? Did anybody's mind change? Did you notice that all of a sudden you awakened up or that the agitation stopped? Right? Whatever, there is this change. So with that, we know from, you know, all the studies that are being done, immediately our body, our blood pressure is going to drop. One of the truly annoying things that I have been able to do in my life is go to physicians who are young and healthy and jogging every day, and then they want to say, you need to exercise more, you need this, you need that, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. And they take my blood pressure, and they're like, is it always this low? And they look at that 30 pounds they think I should lose, and I go, yeah, it's always 97 over 57 or 60. Yeah, I'm a meditator. Of course it's low, you know? Before, when there weren't all these ways to find, and I didn't have to go to the doctor so often, I would always see how low I could get it because I was curious, right? I was like, I wonder how low. And so I would get it so low that they would freak out. So I stopped doing that. But you can do that. You have that option. This is not a unique skill, right? So yes, we live in a society. We live in this time. We have good, we have bad. That's just the quality of this human rebirth. At this moment, oh, we're so, and then there's the suffering of living in Marin. Oh, right? Going through that rainbow, Marin, come on. So we all have suffering. We have the suffering of birth, we have the suffering of aging, and we have the suffering of death. And as we were talking in the car, we all share that with all beings, everything on this earth. The sun will die too someday. Probably not while we're around. Right? This is the nature of it. As I always say, that is the way of it. And yes, some people are having more fun than me. No question about it. I get that. All right? George Clooney, others, I'm sure they're having more fun than me. That's okay. But we all, every being, have this same suffering. No one in this room is exempt from that. None of us know when, how, where. We don't know. Many of us are older. Next week I will be 72. Right? Older. Senior. Really old. I remember when I thought 30 was ancient. So this is the way of it. The body ages. As it ages, we have challenges. Each one of us have different health challenges. How we react to it, that is the beauty of meditation. Peace, happiness, awakening, bliss, nourishment, these are side effects. These are products of meditation. They arise because of meditation. Wisdom, insight, they all arise. They're not necessarily happening when we're on the cushion. Any time you can awaken, even in traffic, and you have an awareness, a clear comprehension of agitation or whatever is arising, that is a meditative state. That is a meditative state. That is knowing. That is a clear comprehension. You're not in it. You're not swept away by the emotion or the story. I drove with a friend many times in Santa Cruz who was consistently agitated when she drove. She loved to drive. She always insisted upon driving. And then she critiqued everyone else's driving. That was her thing. Everyone else. Oh, they're going too slow. They're going too fast. Can you believe that idiot over there? You know, that was her way. Right? And she had to take medication for this. I mean, it didn't help. You know, she could have come, right? What I'm saying is we use these practices as an opportunity to awaken even more. So I want to say about health, just one thing. With understanding that the mind is clear and that it is knowing, that even when we are not healthy, we have an option to embrace it, embrace the subtleties of it, do the best we can, open up, and not allow it to overcome us. So I have multiple sclerosis, and I'm part of this study at UCSF, and it says, has multiple sclerosis made you more, it's basically asking if it made me depressed. Of course it didn't make me depressed. Was I happy about it? Absolutely not. It was kind of unexpected, actually. I mean, I thought I'd die, it was so odd. So the issue is every time I go to UCSF and I sit in that room and I look around, I seriously am one of the healthiest people there. I feel so grateful. I have these amazing doctors. They all look like children to me, but they're amazing. You know? That seriously. I mean, and I am, this is the way this body is aging. This is one of the ways. So, going downhill is not so simple for me. Okay. Right? So I get up in the morning, I put on my glasses, I have to put on my hearing aids, I have to have my cane, and that's the way it goes. How fortunate. How fortunate. How fortunate to have all these options in this world. Can I be depressed about it? Sure, why not? You can be depressed about anything. You can be depressed in Marin, right? The pure land of Marin, right? You can be depressed sitting right here. So the mind is clear and knowing. It has space for everything. We allow it to rise. We see it present. We let it go. We allow it to rise. We see it present. We let it go. We do not have to look at every unhappy state as permanent. We do not have to permanentize it. We do not have to identify with it. It is not I. It is not mine. It is not me. It is just a thought. And for those of you, like my friend who's a linguist, all these smarty pants at Stanford, they don't even know what a thought is. So why grasp onto it? They don't even know what worry is. Why grasp onto it? Why?
So
let it go.
Perfect lead in to the how. How do you get there? How do you know that things are ephemeral? How do you see the thought that's depression? So now you'll get an exercise in this. And I think if you... just raise your hand if you feel like we need a break right now, or if you can last another 15 or 20 minutes with this exercise. Raise your hand if you need a break right now. You're welcome to go to the... take a restroom break and come back if you need to, but I think Andrew's going to explain it now for about 5 minutes, and then we're going to go into it. Yeah.
Yeah, so this practice, it's another layer, another tool that we can use that's available with our meditation practice to bring more awareness, more clear comprehension. And that is sometimes called the labeling technique. I call it the labeling technique, where we actually give a silent naming or label to what we become aware of. And this helps to, it helps us to disidentify with that thought or that feeling or that ache in the knee, to not be in the middle of it, be identifying with it as us, be identifying with the suffering of it and engaging, but just seeing it clearly for what it is. Thinking. Discomfort. Sound. And we can use just very basic labeling. If we have this practice, if this is our practice, or we like to get very specific, we can get more specific about what we notice. Birds, bird song. Frustration. Remembering. But if you find yourself thinking too much about what to label, keep it simple. We don't want to create more thoughts, more stuff, more engagement. Just a simple labeling of what you notice as it arises, the moment that you notice it's present in this vast field of spacious awareness that we really are, that everything arises in, as Jhampa is talking about. So name it and then come back to the breath. And this is a really useful practice. We practice sitting in our cushion or our chair, but then it helps us in the moments of our lives to bring mindfulness to what is arising, to maybe the suffering that's arising or that big, huge donut that's in front of you. And do I really want that? Oh, there's a craving. Am I really hungry? No. Oh, I'm feeling a little stressed right now. Oh, okay. What do I really need? A little more space is created when we label, when we notice. And then that gives us a space to make mindful choice. We talk a lot about wise choice or mindful choice. What is truly the most nourishing choice for me in this moment? What do I really need? So this labeling practice helps to bring skill into the moments of our life, into that mindful check-in. There's also very interesting research that shows that when we label our experience, when we label emotions, that the part of the brain that's involved in that we can measure emotional reactivity, it's called the amygdala, it calms down somewhat. It's less active when we name, when we label. Boredom, there's anger, frustration, or just emotion. That recognition, we start to calm. That simple. So a great practice. They did this study first in general, and they found that this effect happened. Then they looked at a subset of people that were practicing mindfulness and found the effect was even stronger. So it helps to calm the waves, the water, so we can rest more in that clear, vast ocean of awareness. And know, as we say in Buddhism, our true nature. We are not those thoughts. We are not that agitation. We can see it. We can watch it go by. It comes, it goes. So we'll start with simple breath awareness. And then when you notice, that moment of noticing is a moment of wakefulness, mindfulness, thought, sound, simply label. In the simplest form, thinking. Sound, feeling, and then come back to the breath. So finding your comfortable sitting posture, sitting with a nice upright spine, relaxing the shoulders away from the ears, closing the eyes, or having the eyes just relax, slightly open with a downward gaze, if that's your practice or you're more comfortable. And we're going to begin this practice with a few deeper breaths in and out. So just following the breath, down all the way into the belly, feeling the belly expand. Perhaps the chest expanding with air as well. And then releasing on the out-breath. Belly releases, chest releases. And again, just following that sensation of breath as you breathe in. That expansion, the body and the torso. And as you release, again, belly releases, chest releases. And then letting the breath settle into a natural rhythm for you. Resting attention upon the breath. Whatever area of the breath, attention naturally goes to what feels most easy, most familiar. So perhaps it's at the tip of the nose, the chest, the belly. Or maybe attention rests upon the entire course of the breath, the movement of the breath. Knowing that you're breathing. And beginning the labeling practice as you become aware of another object of attention arising and falling away. And then coming back to the breath. And noticing where your attention is now. A gentle labeling. We don't become attached to the label. Just a gentle, short labeling, letting go, coming back to the breath. In just a moment, I'm going to ring the bell. I invite you to notice that millisecond that the bell enters the space of your awareness, noting it until the last sound of the bell passes through your awareness. And I'd like to share a poem called Enough by David White. Enough. This breath is enough. If not this breath, this sitting here. If not this sitting here, this awakening to this life again and again. So labeling practice we can use as is helpful to us. We may just practice with bare awareness, simply noting what arises, coming back to the breath. We may find we like the labeling practice and use that always with what we're noticing. Or we may find it helpful for those more ruminative thoughts or strong sensations that are really grabbing our attention to gently label. And come back to the breath. Like, and we don't want to become attached or engaged with the label either. It's really just a skillful tool.
Can I add some of those, if any of those contents and processes we talked about are things you identify with? I use those as labels all the time, and it just cracks me up. It's self-criticism, mind-wandering, negative mind-wandering, rumination, don't be like a cow, they ruminate. So that, you know, the content and process is another thing you can notice and call out. And when you, you know, especially I think with the self-critical thoughts, when you notice them and call them out, then you can't believe them. You zap them of power. And you're not going to feel bad, you know, in that moment, if you catch that and laugh at it and say that's just the nature of the mind. It's not true. It's just a thought.
Yes, thank you. We have styles of thinking. We can name those styles of thinking. Catastrophizing. Oh, all or nothing thinking. So some of us are familiar with that. However, how this serves you, use it how it is helpful. So we're going to take a 10-minute break, and should we do this in silence? What do you think?
No, I think that for this first break, feel free to meet someone you don't know. And I hate when people say, like, turn to a partner for the first split second. I'm like, no, oh, no. You know, there's this kind of, you know, it's work, and it's like, it's a, you know, making a connection with a stranger. But it only lasts. That discomfort only lasts a second, so connect with someone you don't know.
And I also want to invite you to notice what is nourishing during this break. Turn your attention to notice those nourishing moments, because so often we don't savor our moments. So maybe holding that cup of tea or talking to a new person and looking into their eyes and sharing a smile, but notice that nourishment and savor it. And we'll be talking about that later. It's actually a very wonderful practice that we can do in our lives. So we'll come back at, it's 11:25, back in the room.
I
I need to ring this.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. We can move it down there for you. I've got one on my phone. Oh, good idea. Yeah, and good questions, Bruce. Good questions.
Well, I was thinking cultural.
Of course.
The reason I brought it up was not just to say, it's cultural too, but.
No, it was good.
you know, right?
Joyzy.
label. Label whatever experience you're having right now in your body, sensations, types of thoughts, content, the flavor of emotion. Okay, so
I don't know where that sound is coming
from.
Well,
it's my microphone.
Is it you?
It's me.
I'm on
mute. I will try to not move.
It's getting. Do we have our tech person? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to talk without it for now.
There he is.
So
we're getting a yellow light on this mic and a lot of interference.
I'm going to turn mine on because I probably did something wrong to. Let's say. Can you hear me?
No.
Yes. No.
So.
So while we're waiting, so one of the things we practice is not being attached, right, to what's arising and not being attached to expectations, because there's always little glitches. That's just life. So we just practice being with what is.
Hello.
And it creates a lot less stress, a lot less struggle, a lot less shortening, right, of those telomeres that Alyssa's talking about. And it's something that takes time, but we can actually practice this way of being, meeting each moment.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Okay. I'm going to start just to get us back on track. This section, we cut us into four sections. Section two, what do you really want? In this moment, what are you hungry for? In your life, when you experience hunger, many times we don't know what it is that we're wanting, but we're discontent. We don't feel at ease. We need something in this moment. What is that? Often we turn to food, and sometimes it kind of works in the short run, right? It distracts us. It gives us some kind of dopamine to opioid pleasure, and then that's gone. And then maybe we feel bad again. So one of the things to ask yourself is, besides, you know, what do I really want, is think about what is the difference between love and pleasure. Because we fundamentally mix those up, and so do all of the messages from society, all the marketing messages, the consumerism. The culture tells us that we want pleasure and that we need this and that. We need to buy this. We need to look this way. We need all these superficialities to be happy. And those are short-term aspects of pleasure, buying something, looking some way. So there is a fundamental difference in pleasure and love that comes down to pleasure is driven and regulated by dopamine, the addiction system. And so we feel wanting, and it's dopamine that gets us to the buffet, to the drug, to the store, to the thing that is going to satisfy that we think is going to satisfy our need. Dopamine urges are very, very strong. And the only, you know, the counteract, the antidote, is actually rising above that impulse, those impulses that we all have, especially when we're tired, especially when we're stressed, especially when we're lonely. So there's all these kind of causes and conditions that create this wanting, and we can never satisfy that wanting because it's short-lived and it's always going to leave us wanting more. And so we step above that and we look at what is the antidote, The antidote is love. Love is regulated by a completely different neurotransmitter system, serotonin, different forms of serotonin. And it is that brings us to contentment, meaning, connection. At the end of life, what is it that people say? Do they say, I wish I spent more time in the office. I wish I made more, got more beans, you know, made more money. So, no. It's all about relationships. And have they made these connections? Do they have love? Have they contributed to the world? So the meaning and purpose piece is also tied into contentment and love, not the short-term pleasure. So there's a book about this that my friend and colleague just wrote. It's interesting. It's called The Hacking of the American Mind. It's by Robert Lustig. He's a doctor. He takes a very biochemical view, so it kind of comes down to serotonin versus dopamine, but there are other ways to view this, these forces that we live by that we're going to hear about from Jhumpa. I'm going to just talk very quickly about eating, and because this is a really concrete example of craving and addiction and how we can manage that, break those chains. I can turn this off. Can you hear me if I turn this off? Okay.
I think that one was me.
Are you on mute?
No.
Okay, so we're starting from, think about when you are craving something. And if you would like, you can use food as an example, or you can use something else in your head when you're really wanting something. Now, cravings are very strong ruminative thoughts. They're preoccupation. We have them over and over, and that's why they often win, because they are, it's almost like a survival instinct. I want. And that's what, you know, the impulse to live is tied up with cravings, right? If it's high sugar and high fat, we're programmed to say, dense calories, that's going to help me survive, and that's going to help me feel better. So we get this big pleasure response from dense calories. And so this is not small stuff we're talking about. We're talking about like really hardwired drives. Some of us have it more than others. And there's so many reasons why some of us have mild food addiction, where we're, you know, it really kind of takes over our life. And it puts us on a cycle of needing and wanting comfort food that we know is not good for us. Genetics, overexposure to sugar, stress, all of these can work together. So there's lots of kind of causes and conditions that create this. But we're all eating lots of added sugar, most of us, unless we're like extremely careful. And if we try to deprive ourselves, it often backfires. And so like the dieting, the restraint and the deprivation that dieters go through can't last. All diets end. So that's not the solution. So we train people in mindful eating. And what we can do for people is then, when you use this, and it only works when you use it, this is not a build-up effect like meditation. If you are having cravings and you're about to eat and you're at risk of overeating, you can use this practice of mindful eating to shift your mindset so that you are noticing the craving and you are riding out that urge and you're completely aware of it and in more control of it, and you watch it rise and subside. Andrea is going to lead us through a craving meditation. She's also put it on my book website on the last page, Mind Body Tips page. And it's very powerful. So that's, you know, cravings need attention. If we're going to not give in to them, then then we need our full attention on some of these mindful eating practices, and they really tend to help. So when we teach mindful eating, there's a set of practices we teach. I think the craving management is a critical one. And what do we find? Well, Do people lose weight if they're doing mindful eating? Not really, not in our studies, but they do all of a sudden find equanimity in their eating. So some of you might have experienced a binge. I mean a real binge. So a binge is not just overeating, but it's also feeling out of control, really uncomfortable. And if you do enough of those, you meet criteria for, you know, some eating disorder, like binge eating disorder. And mindful eating can actually dramatically reduce number of binges and take people out of bed, binge eating disorder or bulimia. And our colleague Jean Christeller has done these studies with binge eating. We've done studies with just people who are obese, men and women. They come to UCSF. We've trained them in mindful eating. And here's what we find. Number one, they lose a little bit of weight. And what we guessed was that, okay, if you're really practicing this, it's not going to like lead to dramatically less calories, but it's going to smooth out the eating. So people are choosing nutritious food and they're noticing when they're full. And that should pay off eventually, like maybe 6 months later, maybe a year later. And that's exactly what we found. We found that the people who just got normal kind of diet and exercise training versus that plus mindful eating, they all lost the same amount of weight at 6 months. A year later, those who had mindful eating looked better. They looked better in certain ways. They somewhat tended to keep their weight off. Those who, side note by my colleague Ashley Mason, those who really did keep their weight off had telomere lengthening. That's a new finding that'll come out soon. We were pretty excited by that. And their glucose was lower. And that's what I want to focus on. Health is not about what's on the scale. We cannot control our weight. We have such a robust set point. So unless you're going to tremendously devote your days to changing your you know, what you eat and the amount you burn, you're probably not going to change your weight much. And it can be a really unhealthy goal. But what is important is your glucose and your insulin, your metabolic health. And that is what it turns out that most of these studies of mindful eating do change. So that's pretty exciting. And the more people practice this mindful eating right before meals, the more they ate less of the sweets, those kind of the comfort foods that cause cravings, and they had lower glucose. So we're excited about it. No one's going to do mindful eating every single meal, but Andre is going to share with you some tips that you can try. And it does, the other piece of what it does is you really do feel like you're experiencing a blissful meal, like you actually experience the flavors and the taste and the fullness, because usually we don't. We are not aware and conscious of the experience of eating and fullness. Just we're usually multitasking and we don't pay attention. But when we do, we have all sorts of interoceptive signals like fullness that help us regulate. So I'm going to stop there and ask Jhampa to talk about cravings and wanting.
Yeah, this is such a huge subject in Buddhism, craving. And according to Buddhism, and from my own experience in meditation, I think it bears out that all craving, which is a thirst, really, it's a thirst for satisfaction. And it is the underpinning of all suffering. So, and then based upon craving, we have a grasping nature. And it is very difficult at the beginning to see it arise. So food is a wonderful way to begin to understand how the mind, which is clear and knowing, this consciousness, this mind-heart, that how this arises. It is a bondage. It binds us. And then we suffer. The mind has this nature of stickiness, okay? And I'll talk about it in the most ordinary way. Has everybody here been to Costco? You know, anybody not been to Costco, then you can substitute something. It looks like we've all been there. So one of the things about Costco, I think Costco is the most brilliant way to practice grasping, craving, clinging. It's an ordinary way. We don't have to wait for that big pow moment where we have to grab all our mindfulness because we're at Thanksgiving dinner or something and somebody said something that pissed us off, right? It's a neutral place. First, we're there. We have to find a parking space. Always a fun experience. But then we are a member. How brilliant. I mean, are these people brilliant or what? We're a member. Oh, here's my little card with that picture from 20 years ago, right? And then we go in. And it has been crafted, as we all know, this way. We go down the aisle for the cheap toilet paper, right? And that bottled water, whatever, or that soap. It doesn't matter what your thing is. But we go down. And maybe we're like, I'm very much about the list, right? I'm very much about the list today. I'm going to stick to that list, no problem. And I get all the way to the toilet paper and whatever else I'm looking for. Oh, dishwasher soap, that would be it. Yeah, those little pods, whatever. And then I'm like, I'm good. Yeah, so sticking to my list. And now we have to come back, right? And something caught our eye. So what catches my eye is on the aisle this way with the package of 5 flashlights. Because I've gone on retreat where if you, not to a place like this, where there's like, if you are out in the middle of nowhere and you need at least 3 in case one goes out and then one goes out and then you're hopeful that the moon's out there and you make it back, right? So they can always get me with those and I'll be like, oh, but of course I bought 3 lap, but are they in good shape? You know, whatever. So, right? So we get there. Let's say we even get out past the flowers, the big flowers, and we get in the line. And of course we're always like, why is the line not moving faster? We get to practice a little patience there. But what happens? What's stuck to the mind? What are we craving for?
Chocolate.
Whoa, so dangerous. Okay, yes. So we now make a decision. Are we going to ignore the chocolate? Are we going to ignore it? I went to that nourishment class. I'm not buying that chocolate. Not today. I am so mentally strong with my meditation thing. Then we get in the car, right? How long do we think about the thing we crave that we saw? Shit about those shoes. What about those packs of socks? Oh, gosh, they were really good except for that one color and those stripes. I'm not sure. You know, maybe, oh, gosh, I wonder if they'll have them when I get back. The story, right? We're craving. We're grasping. How many go back in? Do we ever go back in? Have we once gone back in? Do we drive all the way home? Now we have to unpack all that stuff. Have you noticed how heavy it is? I consider it exercise. Lifting, unlifting, carrying. That's why exercise. Okay. How many are, when we get in the house, are we still thinking about it? Do we think? I wonder if they'll have that when I get back. What about that Buddhism book that was on there? You know? Oh, it's Dharma. You know? Right? 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 How long? How long does it stick to the mind? So this is how the mind is, right? In a very simple way. So we talk about this huge thing, which is so subtle when it arises. Craving, grasping, wanting it to be different. The minute we want it to be different, we suffer. The minute, the second, the nanosecond. But we don't always catch it. But when we go to Costco or Trader Joe's, which is a great place to practice patience. You ever notice how cramped it is? And so you notice, oh, yeah, it stuck to my mind. Something inconsequential. Doesn't really matter what it was. Notice how we judge what other people crave. Oh, I would never crave that. Wow, I can't believe they bought that. Yeah, but what we buy, oh, so nourishing, right? Not saying it isn't. Not saying it isn't. But this is the nature of the mind. And Costco, brilliant, because it looks understated, you know, just that concrete thing. But believe me, they've had brilliant minds craft that out to, you know, get all those dollars from us. Okay, so nothing wrong. I like Costco. Nothing wrong. I go there. So this is the nature of the suffering. When we have sticking on our mind whatever chocolate, right, whatever it is, there's that nature of wanting, of dissatisfaction. Oh, when I have that, that itch will go away. Oh, I'd be so happy. Oh, maybe I've already tried them on in my mind, right? Or I already ate it, right? But what happens? We all know this. So we go back. Let's say we buy it. We buy it. You ever notice, watch, next time you go to Costco, how happy everybody is? At the line with all that, you can tell what they intended to buy. You can kind of tell. You may not be accurate, right? Right. I got it. Yay, I'm so happy right now. Right? Right? For a moment. But what happens? Grasping arises again. And why is it important to notice in the mundane? Because this concept is so subtle. It happens so quickly. We respond. And it's hard to get to know. You can spend hours on the cushion, and many have, and still don't quite see that arising. But this is our suffering. We grasp at this I am that. And as the Buddha say, we then sew it together like a seamstress, the past, the present, and the future, and we bind ourselves to it. And we're unhappy. Free yourself up. Free yourself up. It doesn't have to be in Costco. It can be wherever your little place. Whole Foods is up. You know, I've got Whole Foods right across the street. They got a whole lot going on in there. Oh, now they've lowered prices, you know? Well, really? Wow, we're Amazon now. Okay, so, I mean, this is the way. This is the way. And you think we don't have it? Even great practitioners? Even mundane, little, simple practitioners, I mean? I moved from Santa Cruz, California, the home of organic food, no matter what anybody else thinks. They wrote the laws. We have farmers market every other day. You know, I went to Whole Foods in Noe Valley. I moved to San Francisco. Noe Valley, nice place, really. Very lovely. I'm thrilled to be there, honestly. I go to Whole Foods. I'm like, what's with these apples? These are the worst apples I've ever seen in my life. I was suffering. Missing, suffering, because they did not have the Watsonville apples right from the tree right there. And I had to laugh at myself. I'm like, really? Really? This is what you're going to suffer about? You're craving the Watsonville apples today? Yeah, that was my choice of suffering in Noe Valley. So the thing is, we practice in these neutral places, and we practice on the cushion, but then when we're up against it, in the emergency room, with a loved one that is not doing well, when things aren't going our way, and they keep not going our way, you know, when we get that full sweep, you know, that happens, everything seems break up, this, that, whatever, all, right? Then we have the capacity to open to this spaciousness and allow it to be. So what I say is, that is the point of the practice. That is why the practice is all day long. When you look at one of my teachers, the Dalai Lama, right? What do you see? He says, oh, I'm a simple monk. Okay, true. Yeah, maybe. Kind of. And anyway, but look what he holds. This is a man that gets up and does a practice 4 hours every morning. What does he hold with that practice? He holds being thrown out of his country. He holds monasteries being torn and burned to the ground. He holds a population under diaspora and distress. He holds all of that. That's how big the mind is. That's how big your mind is. And I have sat with him and I have heard him say, you are just like me. And we all laugh, don't we? We all laugh. Oh, yeah, right. just like me. But the point is, that's the way it is. You are just like him. You have that clear and knowing Buddhist nature that can behold and have the capacity to hold everything that happens in a moment and not be thrown by it. But it's a practice. It's not going to happen right away. And that is why I encourage you to practice these things every meal, if you can, a meal once a week when you remember. When you go to Costco, halfway through, maybe you'll remember this, or Trader Joe's, and you see, oh, I'm craving that chocolate. And what's with Whole Foods, like making you stand in line with that whole aisle of chocolate? And no, I mean, it's an aisle, practically, half of it. With, I mean, everywhere. I mean, you have to stand there forever. You know, that's when to practice craving. Oh, if I just eat that, I'll be so happy. But notice the suffering of it. Begin to notice the wanting. Notice it. I'm not saying don't eat it. I eat chocolate. I go by Noe Bakery. I have to go through this every time I have to walk up to UPS. Noe Bakery. What's up with it? The smell. You know, I have to decide. Am I walking by? Am I going in? Am I walking by? Am I going in? So obviously you can look at me and know that I've gone in. So the thing is, you know, I'm not saying deprive yourself. I'm saying just notice. Just begin to notice and abandon. Abandon it. Abandon it. Let it arise and let it go. It's a very, if you do this, you allow and you become familiar with craving. That happiness you seek, it may not be the happiness that you think it is. But this is where the majority of our suffering every day is. Trying to make it different. If you can abandon that, still have discernment to do the right thing. I mean, if the bear is running at us, we're not going to say, oh, let me abandon craving. You know, but we're going to go, right? So we all, yeah.
That is that letting go is so profound. It applies to the most minute things, like we talked about rejecting the moment, just not wanting how things are this moment. And it applies to the most profound things in our life, situations that we have, that we might have to live forever with, that we cannot change. And that discontent, wishing things were different, that is suffering. And it's that letting go, realizing that you, it is what it is, and there are many things we can't change, and we always want things to be better, but it's that noticing that wanting and grasping and discontent and letting it go.
And the issue is, wisdom and insight do not arise when we are in craving and grasping. So the more we abandon it, the more access we have to wisdom, to insight, and even discernment. So it is not in the throes of it. And you will notice that in Costco as you're tormenting yourself about whether to, what to crave, what you're craving at. Notice, not much arises then that is helpful. So we want that, we abandon these things. As just ever so slightly, let them.
And so again, the more we practice mindfulness, we practice a formal practice of mindful meditation, bringing mindfulness to the moments of our life, we develop that ability to meet these moments with a more steady attention. And really be able to be present to the discomfort without acting on it and notice it coming and going, cresting, falling away. So I developed a craving practice using these basic principles of mindfulness, being present to discomfort. So it could be an emotion. In this case, we're looking at craving. that experience of craving and getting curious about it. What does it feel like in the body? So mindful attention also includes we bring inquiry, we bring curiosity to the moment. We bring kindness to the moment. It's a great antidote to the judging mind that we spend a lot of time in. And then we're going to bring loving kindness. And I'm going to teach you a basic loving kindness practice. This really is a very powerful aspect that I am practice that I've added to this basic being present with craving without reacting. It can really begin to shift things at a profound level. So first I'm going to teach you, I know many of you have probably already practiced metta. In the Buddhist tradition we call loving kindness metta practice. So metta is this attitude of kindness, of friendliness, we call it loving kindness, that we bring to ourselves and to others. It's a very nourishing quality that we can cultivate through this practice. It's a quality that we can elicit and call upon and bring upon in the moments of our lives to nourish from the inside out. So we're going to do the first part. Traditionally in metta, we begin the practice by offering nourishing phrases of friendliness and kindness to ourselves, then to another that is beloved to us, could be a benefactor, a mentor, and then we go to a neutral person. So we practice with someone we feel neither strong feelings either way, which is a great opportunity to practice. Can we elicit loving kindness? And then we go to a challenging person, and then we go to all beings. So we're going to start today with just offering metta to ourselves and then to another. And then we'll bring this quality into the next steps of our practice. So again, inviting you to get comfortable in your chair or cushion. We've been sitting a while, so I want to just invite you to really uplift and elongate the spine, create some spaciousness as you lift up. Maybe take a deep breath in. Oh, I see some of you lifting your arms up. Beautiful. Let's do that. Just deep breath in, lifting the arms up, hands reaching up to the sky. I'm going to bring some mindfulness to our bodies that love to move. And then exhaling, bringing the arms down. Let's do that one more time. Crossing the arms at the torso, deep breath in. Opening the chest, opening the heart up to the sky. Beautiful blue sky beyond, bringing some of that sky energy, the sun in, exhaling down. Movement is a simple way of nourishing during the day that we often forget about. So you can just bring attention and notice what has changed in this moment to your body, to your attention, to the quality maybe of your thinking. And then closing the eyes. Again, let's take a few deep breaths in and out. I like to start this way because we're actually affecting our physiology, that mind-body connection, helping bring in more of a sense of relaxation, perhaps getting a little head start on quieting the mind just a little bit. And then letting breath settle into a natural rhythm for you, whatever that is. Settling attention upon the in-breath and the out-breath. And now noticing the movement of breath. right at the level of the chest, the center of the chest. Noticing the movement of the breath as it comes in, as it comes out. Perhaps connecting with that nourishing quality of the breath. The breath brings us oxygen, life-giving oxygen. Makes all our cells happy. Breathing out what we no longer need. And now to this nourishing quality of the breath, begin to imagine a sense of warmth, of kindness. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing into the center of the chest, the heart center. And out. And just imagining to the best of your ability a sense of warmth and loving kindness. Beginning to open, to bloom like a flower. So you might imagine a little bud, perhaps a lotus flower, beginning to open. Opening to the sense of kindness, of love. Still letting go. You might be holding on right now to some thought or maybe manifesting as tension in the body that's preventing you from just opening to this moment fully. Opening to this invitation. Allow the sense of loving kindness begin to blossom. Now your bud may have opened a little bit, or you might have a full blooming flower. Whatever it is okay. It's what it is in this moment. And imagining this sense of warmth and loving kindness spreading throughout your body. You might even imagine it, if you're very kinesthetic oriented, as a warmth, as a warm sun, golden sun spreading upward, up the torso, above the chest, into the neck and the head, down the arms, to the hands, fingers. Down the torso, down into the pelvis, the legs, the feet, toes. Flowing into all the cells and the spaces between yourselves. Perhaps flowing nourishment into your very telomeres. Just for a moment, breathing the sense of warmth, loving kindness in and out throughout the whole body. Opening. Notice if you're meeting any resistance or aversion to this practice. That creates a sense of suffering. Can you let go, and just simply open to the breath, into this invitation of just fully being here in this moment, breathing in this sense of kindness, friendliness, out. And now we're going to offer into this pool of kindness you've been cultivating some of the traditional loving kindness phrases. And you might imagine that as you offer them, they're like a petal on that flower. And you're just dropping that petal into this pool of water, this pool of your spacious awareness, of your being, and letting it ripple as it may. So you don't need to force anything or effort, just offering this phrase of well-wishing to yourself. So I'm going to repeat some phrases, and you repeat them silently to yourself. Wishing yourself well. May I be well. May I be happy and healthy. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be safe and embraced in the arms of loving kindness. May I be filled with loving kindness. Continuing to repeat these phrases or any of your own to yourself. May I be well. May I be happy. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be filled with loving kindness. And now, imagining someone in front of you in the field of your heart, someone that you care about, beloved, benefactor, mentor, could be a pet that you love deeply. Just imagine this person or pet in front of you, the field of your heart. And now offer these phrases of loving kindness to them. And if two people slip in there, that's okay. May you be well. May you be happy and healthy. May you be peaceful and at ease. May you be safe and embraced in the arms of loving kindness. May you be filled with loving kindness. And now taking a moment, letting go of the image of that person or pet, the beloved one, and then just bringing attention back to yourself, breathing this sense, this nourishing sense, loving kindness in and out. You might put a hand on your heart, or even two hands, and just offer this to yourself. How often do we offer loving kindness to ourselves? You deserve it. Just rest in this. Perhaps once again being aware of the nourishing quality of the breath. And then bringing your attention back to the whole of the body. Noticing what's changed from this practice. Sensations in the body. Quality of attention, of experience, thought. This quality that you've been practicing eliciting is yours to nourish with your attention, with your practice. Then bringing attention back into the room, opening your eyes when you're ready. So we've spent a little bit of time nourishing with loving kindness practice. We're going to go right into the craving practice. And this is a practice I usually do towards the end of a day or the end of a long retreat or the end of a week or a series of classes or month of working with someone, but we're doing it here. And you don't have to get it the first time, but we want to give you the tools to work with it. But let's take another stretch because we have bodies too and they like to move. So bringing the hands to the side, and yes, and you're welcome to stand if you'd like. Deep breath in. All the way up. Ah, reaching those fingertips up to the sky. turning the palms outward, exhaling down. Crossing the arms, the torso, exhaling up. Raising the head up, eyes looking up towards the skylights up there. Or whatever, wherever your eyes fall upon, and then exhaling. Beautiful. And then coming back to your seat, and we'll just do a little side twist in our seats. So sitting nice and straight, nice and tall, and then bringing the left hand back, right hand on right thigh, and then gently turning towards the back. Now, always honoring your body and what you know is okay for your body, for any pose that I may teach or offer today. And whenever you do practice, you might just gently look over your left shoulder, breathing from the back body, and then letting go, taking a breath into the center, and bringing the right hand to the back of the chair, left hand on right thigh, and then gently twisting, looking over your shoulder. Breathing from that back body. And then coming forward. And then one more, reaching up. Filling up with that nourishing air. Exhaling. And now, any movement that your body wants to do. If you want to shift back and forth. All right. So we're doing this practice right before lunch. We're going to be break soon. So again, we're going to be using those principles of mindfulness, of being able to meet an uncomfortable sensation with a stable attention, with kindness, with curiosity, with inquiry. We don't have to get in the middle. So often during the day when we're not practicing, we're forgetting, we're right in the middle of our struggles, of our feelings, of our cravings. So we're going to practice, what is it like to rest more in awareness, spacious mind, and be curious. So closing your eyes once again, bringing attention to the breath. I'm going to ask you to visualize a food that tends to be a trigger for you, perhaps to overeat, or food that when you see or smell, you just want it, even when you're not hungry. It might be a food that you crave during a difficult experience, from a challenging circumstance or strong emotion. And perhaps if this is all very new to you, mindfulness practice, perhaps maybe not imagining the most difficult food, but one that elicits some craving, but not the strongest craving. And as you visualize the food in front of you, notice the textures, the colors, the smell. Really seeing this food in front of you, and as the image of this food becomes stronger, and you are seeing it and smelling it before you, begin to imagine the feeling of craving growing. Perhaps it's already started. And just imagining this vividly. It's okay, we're practicing in a field of mindfulness, so just inviting it in. What does this craving feel like? placing that food in front of you. Now breathing in, noticing the air, perhaps cooler as it comes in through the nose and warmer as you exhale. Releasing any tension you might be experiencing from the craving. And now begin to imagine a feeling of kindness and even compassion filling you in any way comfortable for you. It's remembering that practice we just did and when we flooded our body, awareness with loving kindness. Imagining that feeling of kindness, of loving kindness, compassion filling you. You may put your attention on your heart if you wish, and imagine it being filled up with this sense of warmth and loving kindness. You also may wish to put a hand on your heart. And just letting this feeling flow outward from the center of your heart, this sense of warmth and loving kindness spreading throughout your body. And now enveloping this sense of craving with warmth and loving kindness. You might even get curious about it, like where is this craving in the body and what's its shape, its texture, how big is it, how small? Just that bare sensation and then flooding it, enveloping it with a sense of loving kindness. Embracing it. Meeting it with friendliness. It's okay. Now sitting for another moment, just breathing in the sense of loving kindness, of compassion for yourself. Craving is not unique to you. You're not bad or wrong for feeling it. We all suffer in this way. You can meet it with kindness, compassion. And again, just breathing in this sense of kindness, softness, compassion for yourself. Yeah, just letting go of any way you were beating yourself up, even for having this. It's just part of being human. And now bringing your awareness to the food again. So seeing it in your mind's eye, What has changed? What are you aware of in your body, your mind, your heart? What is your experience in this moment? And now bringing your attention back to the room and slowly opening your eyes when you're ready. So we'll have an opportunity after lunch. We'll have a little some time for questions and reflection on the morning. So anything you might want to share from this practice, but just noticing what has changed. You've nourished from the inside out with mindfulness, loving kindness practice.
Can I ask you, can you do that with grasping at something, a situation, not food? A lot of people don't have necessarily mm-hmm. cravings
for food. Absolutely. You can use this practice with strong emotions, challenging emotions. Absolutely. And bringing loving kindness, enveloping in loving kindness. Getting curious, we can get curious about if we're having a very strong emotion, we can bring this sense of curiosity to explore. Just what's the bare sensation of it? Do you have any thoughts associated with it? Oh, that's why, that's what's going on. Oh, how true is that? I can just let go of that thought. Maybe I need a few breaths right now. In this space of inquiry, space gets created, and then we can see emotions, thoughts for what they really are, and nourish ourselves, make a choice, a conscious choice, to nourish ourselves with what we really need, what we would like to consciously in that moment. Okay? Sometimes it is chocolate, but it's mindful. Eating with mindful, and Jhampa's laughing. I had to bring that in. We're going to do a chocolate practice at the end of the day. But whatever we're doing, mindful eating, whatever choices we're making, we make with mindfulness. And we don't need to beat ourselves up about those choices. So we might nourish with a piece of dark chocolate and really enjoy and let go of the accompanying thoughts that are often there, even if we don't realize it. If we put attention, oh, I shouldn't really have this. It's not in my diet. Cheating. Let yourself have a piece of chocolate and enjoy it. So for lunch, we're going to bring present-oriented attention, present moment attention to our eating. I'm going to invite you to, when you take out your lunch, to first look at it. Look at the colors, the textures. Look at this meal that you've chosen to bring, hopefully mindfully, knowing you are going to be in a retreat today. Take a moment to contemplate. Think about where this food came from. It didn't just arrive. What went into making this food? And that includes nature. That includes the sunshine and the water and the earth, and the hands that perhaps picked the food, how it got to you. So really open up this sense of interconnectedness with the food. And then I'm going to invite you to use all your senses. Smell those first few bites of food. Taste. Really pay attention to the taste, to the chewing, savor. Even notice when you swallow. Some of us have habits where we're eating so fast we're swallowing while putting food in the mouth. So even pay attention to that and how you feel. be partway through your meal. Check in. How does my body feel?
And notice if you start working, if there's some problem that you're trying to solve and you don't even notice, and so you're keeping yourself vigilant and not completely focused on the eating experience. And then what is it like to just focus on eating? It's really different. Is this silent?
We're going to what I'd like to do, and we often do this on our longer retreats, let's have the first part of the meal in silence. So if there's someone you came with or maybe someone you met and you want to eat with, you can maybe begin, set yourself up, but do your first part of the meal in silence and practice in this way. And then if you'd like to, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes in, shift to talking, and notice what's that's like. Can I stay connected to this experience? Being aware of the food, letting it nourish me, noticing when I'm satisfied and I've had enough, but also be aware of the other. And this is a skill. We're just going to bring curiosity to this. This is something we work on with our longer retreats, or people that are, you know, working on this one-on-one. And then, of course, if you want to be in silence the whole hour, absolutely, please enjoy many silent retreats at Spirit Rock. So across right across the way here, we have many benches. There's a lovely park-like setting. So you can set yourself up over here. You can sit outside. If you know you want to be in silence the whole time, just sit a little apart. And then once you're done with eating, really give yourself over to nourishment. What would be the nourishing choice for me right now? Let the cell phone be away. It's going to be there, right, when you leave.
Try to protect this time from the news. There are a couple little rooms upstairs. If you want to lie down, you can lie down in here too. Just do whatever your body needs, and no one will judge you if you fall asleep here during lunch. And come back in an hour for stress resilience. Do not miss it.
We have a couple more announcements. So Alyssa and I will be doing a book signing of our new books.
One book, so don't rush back to get it, because.
But
I'm happy to sign it if anyone buys it. But I'm nothing formal.
My book is called Well Nourished, and it is all about nourishment, inner and outer nourishment. It's full of practices, workbook style. We're touching upon a few of the practices today. I'm really looking at what are you truly hungry for, beyond food. But also some core mindful eating practices so that we can have that, build that healthy relationship. So I think our clocks are a little different. I have 12:36. So we'll come back at 1:35. I'll be back here 10 minutes before there's a table signing books, or if you just want to talk to me. We have a mailing list. I have 10 tips to mindful eating. If you'd like to receive that, you can put your name on my mailing list. And Jhampa, do you have anything that you want to add?
Enjoy your meal. Yeah. Enjoy it.
Andrea, may I just say one thing? Somebody who has a black Jeep parked behind somebody else who would like to leave. So if you have a black Jeep, you can see me and I'll give you the license plate number. Thanks. Have a beautiful lunch. It's gorgeous outside.
Yes. Thank you, Rami. Yes, savor your hour. And we'll see you in a little bit.
to? One, two.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.